Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamata satavara ye sorvanta bamunjantu sadang. This is the observance night, and we have about 3 weeks left of this vasa. So just as an exercise in awareness, what right now, what is the vasa? Perception, isn't it? Memories arise. End of the vasa, 3 weeks from now, is the future, which is in the present. And thinking about the end of Pavarana day, Katinas, these haven't happened yet. So the future, these things are likely to happen, but maybe who knows what will happen. The world might end before the end of the vasa. Just to reflect on the way it is, future is what hasn't happened yet, so we project. You know, we end of vasa, katinas, next year. It'll be the spring, the autumn equinox in a couple of days. When the days and nights are even. And then it goes into days get shorter and the nights longer. And then the beginning of vasa, the memory, when we made our determination, and everything that's happened up to this moment. So memories arise according to conditions. We wouldn't be thinking about the beginning of vasa right now if I didn't bring up the subject. So conditions for recalling the beginning of vasa are here. So that memory will arise. This is a way of reflecting on the way it is. They're always returning to the moment, the here and now. So then, memory, we remember only certain things. We don't remember everything that's happened during this vasa. Just the more, maybe the pleasant or the most difficult things that have happened to you during this time, you might remember. Future, who knows what? Enlightenment, finding true bliss and happiness, might end up in total despair, suicidal, might be a terrorist attack on Amaravati. Anything, you know, anything you can think of could happen, possible. Martians coming, or Venusians, UFOs. You know, you can even make up total kind of absurd fantasies about it if you want. But in terms of right now, the future is what we don't know, is it? It's not the future, then is perception. The word future, the future is about the unknown, the potential possibility. Now this establishes this awareness. This is the way it is. The Dhamma, the way the Dhamma is the truth of the way it is. And if you keep reflecting like this, then you break down your your illusions about the reality of time. You know, because that we live in a society that believes totally in time as reality. Where this is, the Western world is, you know, very proud of history, keeping records of the past, preserving Britain. They're always trying to preserve everything of the past. Any old, horrible old house that is any age has to be preserved. A few years ago, 10 years ago, they were trying to preserve the first slum in England, up in Yorkshire. Because history, you know, it gives us a sense of continuity. It's like your own personal history, doesn't it? It makes you feel like you've been somebody, a real person, because you have a birth certificate, a passport, and you have memories of, you know, when you were a child, when you went to school, went to work, so forth, and these are, give us a sense of being somebody that has continuity in time. And so in awareness, this dissolves into nothing, and that can be pretty frightening for many. For most people, I think, when their egos start falling apart, because it's like you're emotionally very, it's terrifying. It's even better to, you know, to hold on to terrible memories. It at least gives you a sense of being somebody that was abused and so forth, treated badly. That's somebody, that's a memory of being, you know, that if you get a lot of abuse, then it does create a sense of being somebody who gets abused. So even the difficulties of life, when we hold on to the memories, create this sense of a permanent personality, a soul, that has a history to it. Fascinating about previous lives, isn't it? We become fascinated by what were my previous lives. And because that's interesting to think of, you know, somebody can read your aura and you can figure out you were, you know, somebody in China or India or Rome, you know, during the ancient times. You know, several monks have gone to Rome into the Colosseum and remembered being killed by lions or wild animals. So that it gives you a sense of having been somebody in the past. So right now, what are you? Can you find yourself? You know, can you find, is there a memory that you can sustain? You know, even a previous life memory of being eaten by lions in the Colosseum, or yesterday, or the greatest moment of your life, if you remember it, can you sustain anything like that for very long? Or being abused, or unloved or mistreated. So I don't know about you, but I can't. I've tried. just to see if I could do it, you know, just to begin to see just the evanescence of memory. There's nothing much to it. except when we grasp it and believe in it and make it. We can create things around memory. So right now, say, with this reflective or intuitive awareness, you know, I can't find anybody. Because I can see through the limitation of memory. I'm not looking for myself as some kind that I remember being anything. And I can't create something and believe in that either. So I can't find a personality that I can say is really mine. The body, you begin to see, is like, you know, the flowers in the garden or anything that grows and, lives on this planet. It's just a condition in nature. So at this moment, then you begin to recognize, realize this empty point, still point of pure awareness. I can't find Ajahn Sumedho or anything like that. It doesn't mean anything anymore. And yet, you know, if I cling to this name, Ajahn Sumedho or whatever, then I can, you know, I can create a scenario about me as a personality that ordained and did this and that in the monastic life. We have quite an interesting lot of memories to entertain you all about my life as Sumedho. But then the reality of this moment is that I can't find it, you know, there's just. And then a lot of the memories that I would tell others, I only tell you the stuff I want you to hear. Isn't it? It's a selected biography of Sumedho. So these are not trustworthy. You know, these are not anything to develop that much interest in or commitment to is oneself as a person or a physical being. Even it's important to recognize its limitations, not to despise or deny or reject, but to recognize the way it is. So I've been in Norway for the past week. That's a perception, isn't it? Everybody knows Norway is a country in Scandinavia, Northern Europe. And so we can talk about my experiences in Norway. And so that Norway now is a memory. Even when I was there, you know, what am I doing? It's just memories, it's perceptions rising up. Everybody there in Norway believes they're in Norway. So we all agree on that. we call this England, don't we? We all agree to call this place England. It actually doesn't have a name, except we give it one. Right now, Norway is a memory for you. For most of you, it's an abstraction. You know, if you've never been there, you don't have any memory of it, except reading about it and seeing it on a map. And then we have certain perceptions of what Norway is about. Snow and skiing and when you would say Norway, what kind of perceptions arise? So investigating how the mind is, you know, because you know, we give, you can, you know, in the world today, everybody totally committed to their delusions. You know, the war and the American occupation of Iraq, Tony Blair, George Bush, these are all perceptions of the mind. And yet we can get very indignant or excited or wound up just by saying these names. As by nowadays, as most people I know say George Bush, and they, you know, you feel this tension arise. It's only, you know, two words. W. You can't say W anymore, they're going tense. Or Tony. Tony is a common name, and now say Tony and everybody, you know, can't trust that guy. They're just noting these reactions, not condemning or saying you shouldn't have them. They're just observing the way it is, how things can affect us, how the emotions are created around the liking, disliking, approving, disapproving. In Norway, they had the Thai ambassador invited myself and Ajahn Panya Saro, and so we had, you know, kind of red carpet treatment, staying in the embassy and in Oslo, and a chauffeured Mercedes Benz, and I was just black sedan, very impressive, and. Then ambassador was with us all the time, took a great deal of interest. He's quite interested in meditation. In fact, he's been on retreats here. Well, that's good to see, isn't it? It's to see that a Thai ambassador who has a lot of duties and, you know, is high up in the social order begins to see through. You know, he's you know, awakened to all the foolishness and pointlessness, and yet he's in a you know, has a good job and highly regarded and interesting life. Yet there comes a point where it's never enough, either just to have, you know, high status and wealth and success and all the rest. On the worldly plane. It's interesting, Norway seems as, you know, almost a perfect country, because we were there just when the weather's very nice. You know, I don't know how perfect it is in the winter, but in the autumn, it's incredibly beautiful, very clean, much cleaner than England. Like Oslo is you know, you could eat off the pavement so clean. And you don't see litter and plastic bags lying around like you do in London. And everything seems to, you know, be much, you know, well-ordered and friendly place. Very lovely city, beautiful fountains and parks. They have one park that we've enjoyed was the Bigland Park, which is quite famous, well, you might know about it. He was a sculptor who created this park, and all these very impressive granite sculptures of human beings in various stages of emotion and action, movement. So they have this huge column in the middle, and, you know, this kind of like a mound, and this huge column of human bodies sculpted in one piece of granite, very, you know, almost as high as this temple ceiling. and all these figures of humanity, men, women, old men and old women, and children and babies and corpses, all kind of on top of each other in various ways, in various, you know, old naked figures in these kind of sculpted on top of each other in a most amazing way. So it's like all this incredible bit of interesting art, really, carved out of a solid piece of granite. Very skillful, very skillfully done. And then surrounding this column are all these kind of gargantuan figures of men and women, all nude, in various poses of despair or in love or anger or depressed or elated, or the children, old people, thin people, fat people, everything there. And then here, everywhere these figures, huge granite figures are. And children are climbing up on top of them. So then, in the same part, the same artist developed the fountain at the center. The Norway thing, they seem to create in Oslo most beautiful fountains, water fountains, in the park. They're quite original, very beautiful. This one is of these, it's done in bronze, it has these kind of very strong figures of men holding up this huge kind of disc with the water coming up and flowing over, and then surrounding it, it's in a square, the various stages of birth and death of human men and women in bronze. And they have these kind of in trees, the tree figure, big tree figure, then the children or the men and women somehow related in this tree. And the tree is the kind of the continuous theme with the human figures, you know, in them or trying to get out of them or hanging on to them, or in forms of children, youth, old age, and death. There's even one with a ghost in it. One tree has a ghost in it. So it's a good contemplation, if you like, reflecting on these things, because it's a very humanistic park. And then that's what I found in Oslo, was everywhere there's figures of human beings everywhere, in all the parks where we go, to naked human beings, children or whatever. And they seem to, you know, it's a country that seems to have kind of elevated the sense of being human to be their kind of peak of cultural achievement. You don't get the impression it's a highly religious country, you know, that spiritually it doesn't seem all that tuned in. The churches look pretty empty and like museums. And then with all these figures in the Bigland Park that are, you know, doing all these various things, these passionate poses, or depressed, or angry, or men fighting, or whatever, there's no, nobody's ever created a Buddha image. I've noticed this in Western iconography, even in Christian iconography, there's no kind of equivalent to a Buddha, Buddha Rupa. This is just contemplating this, that the Buddha Rupa is a kind of, to me, a kind of ultimate achievement in presenting the human form in perfect balance, isn't it? Where the eyes are open, there's composure, there's, you know, it's not depressed or angry or laughing hilariously, but calm and clear and balanced, a sense of emotional balance and equanimity, enlightenment, the human form that had that where the consciousness is no longer clung to out of ignorance. So, in this way, the Buddha icon is to me a kind of the ultimate product of, you know, that comes out of contemplation, reflection, and experience. So we're used to the passionate forms in European culture, aren't we? The warriors and the kings and the queens and the scientists and the everything from gnomes to dwarfs to fairies and whatever variations on human form, in either exaggerated or photographic likenesses, the human form is the vehicle that we all are experiencing at this moment. So, when we go into take on the position, say, of ideals, you know, of becoming something, becoming the king or the warrior or the queen or the common man or the whatever role you incline to, you know, on a personal level, then we tend to develop into that. We become like that. Whatever we grasp, we become what we are grasping. So if we're, you know, if we feel despair and hopeless, then we become someone who's depressed. If we want to become a warrior, one who fights and is heroic, then we have to do things to prove that we are that way, the identity of a hero. And yet, how many heroes, you know, you might be sculpted and put into a public park as a great hero, but the man or woman themselves, how can you hold on and be a hero 24 hours a day? You know, you can make it out of granite, which can last hundreds of years, but the actual moment is very brief, of the joy, the kind of exultation of being heroic is not a condition that you can sustain. It's very brief and then it's gone. Being a winner, a champion. So then if your things you're grasping are so high up, you know, the higher they are, the more difficult they are to sustain. So if you get too refined and too special, then it's hard to maintain that, the illusion of being that for very long. So then we kind of sink into just an ordinary guy, really. You know, I have special talents, done all right. getting by, and this is what we often hear in England, you know, people just committed to a level of kind of mediocrity as themselves, because at least that's more sustainable, isn't it, than having to always be the hero, the champion. So, you know, that's hard work, sustaining that illusion of the extremities. Imagine you go into the hell realm, being really evil would be a hard one to sustain. You know, if you really committed to being the most evil human being on the planet. But I think the miserable states seem to last longer than the ethereal ones. It's not fair, is it? But it is just the way it seems. Like heaven, you know, a more 5 minutes of happiness, you know, is very brief. It's like a second, and it's over. 5 minutes of misery is like an eternity. Like when you're looking at the clock waiting for the bell to ring, 5 minutes, and your legs are aching. And you think, just be patient. 5 minutes is not very long. And you think, 5 minutes have gone by, and you look at the clock. Only 1 minute has gone. And then you start hating the monk in charge of the bell because you think he's doing, not bringing it deliberately to torture you. You start projecting. So by even grasping the fact that I'm just a nobody, an ordinary guy with, you know, that is also created. That's a created condition. It's not the way it is. Oh, we might see ourselves in more negative terms even. It's like, I'm hopeless, I'm no good, I can't do anything right, and that, and we get into really depressive mental states. And it's interesting, the ambassador said that Norway has the highest suicide rate in Europe. So I thought, you know, this is perfect a place as to live in as you could find on this planet. Why isn't everybody happy? Yeah, it's well-run, good government, welfare system from cradle to grave, take care of you no matter what. Wealthy, clean, beautiful, democratic. Sounds, you know, it sounds as good as you can find, and yet has a high suicide rate. Why is that? Why would, if everything was so nice like that, why would people want to kill themselves? But it's strange, that's what happens, isn't it? The higher suicide rates are usually in the affluent world. And this, because, you know, if you're, one thing about being poor and where you have to strive to survive, there's a purpose to your life, isn't it? You know, if you've just got to, you know, got to forget yourself and just try to find enough rice to feed yourself and your family for the day, you can't think about life all that much and how, you know, about yourself. You've got to put some effort into just basic survival. Not that I'm promoting poverty, but I'm just reflecting on when life becomes too easy and there's no challenge, and we can easily drift into, and there's no spiritual goal in it. You're just, you know, you're just looking for happiness and you know, ease and comfort and exciting things and romance and adventures, and all this gets very boring after a while. Just this endless pursuit of happiness and seeking all the time for some kind of pleasure through the senses or through power or through, you know, just through grasping the conditioned realm, the samsara. It just, after a while, if there's no challenge, if there's nothing beyond it, it becomes rather dreary. Like as you get older too, you see how, you know, you've seen enough and you're a bit weary of it all. You've seen the same things over and over again, and the kind of stupidity of your own mind, conditioned mind, and the society you're in. So then you have this nipitta, kind of world weariness. So the Buddha, you know, encouraged us to reflect and know the world as the world. And this means what we create out of ignorance. It doesn't mean the planet Earth. When the Buddha talks about the end of the world, he's not talking about Armageddon in the sense that we mean that, but it's pointing to the world we create, because each one of us lives in our own world, you know, and you begin to recognize you create the world that you're living in. If you're in Norway or England or Thailand or wherever, and the kind of memories and the sense of yourself, your history, your status, all these are things you create and recreate, keep and grasping and believing in. So we can live our lives just seeking adventures and challenges, even though like adventure. I like adventures, you see. So it's always nice to have an adventure to look forward to. So this is, and even in old age, you know, I'm not so fit anymore, so I'm not... I went to the museum in Oslo where they have where the expeditions of the Arctic, and they have the boat, the big boat, the Fram that crossed the northern Northwest Passage, and had all these photographs, and I find it's just incredibly interesting, you know, the Arctic, having, you know, been there last May, and then this kind of intensity of effort that the like Nansen and people like that put into finding the Northwest Passage in the early part of last century. And they can be iced in, you know, caught up in the north all winter long in the freezing cold. And it shows the boat is completely covered with ice and snow. And just, you know, being stuck, not knowing if you're ever going to get out of this. And yet there's something exciting about it. And yet you have to be patient, because, you know, you're going to spend 6 months frozen in a frozen ship, surviving. But there is a level of purpose to one's life then, isn't it? To survive when you're on the edge, and you're going to survive and get out of there. There's some kind of thrust to one's life, meaning, you know, winning, achieving, being the one who finds the Northwest Passage, who goes to gets to the North Pole first. That gives one a purpose. But going back to Oslo, sitting in your nice, lovely flat, and with its central heating and double glazed windows, you want to kill yourself, no meaning anymore. Because if that's all you have to look forward to, isn't it? It's just central heating and thick carpets and pickled herring and it's kind of, you know, it's nice when you don't have those things, but once you have them, then they become meaningless. So in the monastic life, you know, being a Buddhist monk, that's an adventure, because you get frozen in sometimes. And, you know, you go through various things. But the whole point, isn't it? It's got a purpose for this realization. At least this, for me, this has been a great adventure, because of the way my mind works. You know, just noticing what a tyrannical superego I have. And having to learn how to understand that, and how to not get caught, not get hooked by it, because it's very powerful. And it's supported by cultural conditioning and the way everyone thinks anyway. It's not just some kind of neurotic, freaky thing of mine. It's very much conditioned by society and the family and ethnic background that I'm from. A sense of self and the judgmental side. Incredible critic that complains and criticizes endlessly me. So living with this has not been an easy ride. Having these conditions in consciousness, because. Even though to you I might look like easygoing character, it's not been easy, because it's a constant challenge to not get hooked, or if you get hooked to wake up to that, and once you recognize that the hooks are your own attachments. You know, it's not like anything's hooking me, it's just how I attach to those habits of mind, the critical faculty, or the emotional habits that I have. How I'm so ashamed of a lot of them, some of the emotional habits. You know, not because they seem so stupid and immature. Or, you know, the vanity and conceit, or these kind of mental states, you know, are humiliating, embarrassing, and because one doesn't want to be seen, and hopes other people don't notice, because we have the conceit of wanting to be somebody, you know, an image of something in the society where people look up to you and respect you and like you. And then your fear of being rejected or being criticized or humiliated in some way by the society or by others or even one other person. Like being humiliated brings out rage in me. Somebody humiliates me, I feel I could, you know, I could, if I didn't respect the Bhanadibhata precept, I could easily be a murderer. I felt like murdering people sometimes, especially when humiliated. And yet life does provide us with endless humiliations, isn't it? Old age is you know, it's getting increasingly humiliating to my ego. It's not kind, you know. So then, the decrepitness of an aging body and so forth is not, you know, isn't how the ego wants to be seen. You know, you want to be seen as still vigorous, strong. Find yourself caving in and not walking so quickly and. your joints seizing up a bit, things like this. And if your ego is strong, you know, not wanting to be considered old, like we're very, you know, we're a youth, raise youth to a high pinnacle of high, you know, that's what we'd like to be all the time, young and beautiful forever. And yet, that's not the way it is. That reaches a peak and then it's downhill. You don't get younger. So then the awareness, isn't it? The Buddha pointed to old age, sickness, death as the messengers. They're the things that wake us up. Oftentimes being healthy and young and beautiful can make us very dozy. You know, we can have a lot of pleasure riding on those kind of conditions, identifying with them, but you can't sustain them. So the signs of old age or sickness, disabilities, death and loss, separation, seeing the loved ones die, being around dying people, sick people, and so forth, they're oftentimes for many of us the awakening, the awaken us to beginning to look at life, not complain about it and blame God or whatever for it, but begin to, what is it all about? What is its purpose? What is its meaning? What is it all about, anyway? So when you start asking those questions, then you can't get the answers from anybody. Because you don't want an answer, you just, those very questions open you up, because you have to stop just grasping and repeating the same things and start noticing, observing, witnessing, paying attention to all the habits you've already acquired, to the body, not to complain about it because it's getting old and blame God for ruining your beautiful appearance, but to understand it. You know, we can't just take it for granted. Like when you're young and healthy, you can take a lot for granted. You can make your body do anything you want, almost. But then you can't sustain that, isn't it? It lasts for a while, and then you can't do it anymore. Body will not do what you want. And then when you get into middle age and old age, you know, it's not going to do what I want. It's going to be the way it is. So it's learning to recognize this, to open to it, so it's not a rejection or a dismissal of it, but a willingness to understand it, to learn from old age, sickness, death, separation, sorrow and grief. It's not a depressing thing that Buddhism is about, suffering and grief and despair, because that is really not understanding the Buddha in any way decent at all. It's pointing to these in order to awaken, to turn to understand, rather than running away from them. Because the usual reaction is to run away from anything unpleasant, get away from it. As soon as we have pain in the body, give me an anodyne, an analgesic, an aspirin, paracetamol, morphine, anything. And I can get rid of it as quickly as possible. They want to get rid of any emotional discomfort or physical discomfort as quickly as possible is a very natural reaction. It's not unnatural. But if that's all we do, then our life is increasingly more difficult as you get older. So The Buddha's advice was to understand. It means to turn to something. To understand something, you have to accept it, recognize it, allow it to be what it is, not try to complain about it because it isn't what you want. But even if it's what you don't want at all, you can understand it, learn from it. So then this is the practice of awareness, sati sampajanya. Then in the adventure, realm of adventure, it's not like you just suddenly solve the problem and then it's an easy ride. You learn, you discover how to learn from the way it is as the conditions change. So you're discovering or you're realizing, recognizing the way of understanding the conditions for what they are, the way it is, the suchness, the dattada. In Pali they use this dattada, dattakada. This word conveys what they are in translating, which is suchness or as is, the way it is. It's not, as soon as you want to label and judge the way it is, then it becomes more than what it is. As soon as I name something, it's slightly more than what it is. It's learning to trust in the awareness before a name for anything comes up. It's a kind of going into this empty state, not disappearing into a void of nothingness, but recognizing when the consciousness is quite empty, when you're not grasping anything, when there's awareness of being, before you acclaim it or judge it or even name it. When we give names to things, then we go fall back into the old patterns of what I like, don't like, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. That we get into, it's wrong, I'm right, you're wrong. And we get caught back into the cycle of our superegos and our emotional habits. So we get caught in this swirling cycle of samsara again. So the way out of that is through awareness of it. So, encourage you to, because trying too hard and always trying to get something from meditation, you're not going to get what you want. So, If you preconceive some goal of what you want, you're not going to get it. So it's going to be terribly disappointing. Some people feel very disappointed having meditated for years because they're always expecting to get something that they never quite get. Or if they do get, they lose. Anything you get, you lose. So even attainments in concentration and all that, you're going to lose them. You can't sustain them. So it's a different, that attaining is a worldly condition attitude, that's the way the world operates. Getting something, achieving something, becoming is the worldly mind way of thinking, the way we see ourselves or even our meditation practice, or we even interpret Buddhism in those terms, even though that's not what is that, but it doesn't work. If you're going to practice, it doesn't work like that. You don't attain. You don't get something. Or if you do, you lose it. You know, I've attained, you know, refined states, and I lose them. And then you want them. When you lose it, you know, and then you remember you want it again. So you go, you try to get it again, you know, you keep doing all the things that you remember doing, you know, to get those blissful states. And then sometimes you might get it, you know, but you can't keep it. And after a while you know, you get very into controlling everything. You've got to control everything around you. So, to me, I'm not interested in that. That as such always leads to kind of despair and disappointment anyway. So, what I've found more useful is in the awareness of that, of trusting in this awareness in the here and now. Learning to recognize it, to really appreciate it, treasure it. So it's not like an attainment, it's through real, by paying attention. And learning to recognize what grasping, how grasping, you know, when you can't do it, you're grasping something and you're trying to get something, or you grasp the idea of what I'm saying, but yeah, and you don't see that you're grasping it. But as you begin to observe just the tension of grasping, of wanting, of not wanting, of trying, and all the rest, then you begin to see that the attention that is sustainable is not through just, you know, willfulness. There's some the right effort is a balanced effort. Not just me determining to get it. So it becomes more sense of open receptivity, kind of relaxed attention, a listening, an attunement to now, and really willing to look at things as they are, the anicca dukkha anatta of sankharas. You know, those are the ways to investigate, to just notice the limitations of conditionality. Of its, you know, it is, its nature is like this. The grasping is the cause of the suffering. So it's the grasping of samsara, not samsara even. So it's back to this grasping. And then you see the grasping, how the, you know, whenever you're suffering, you're unhappy or upset or angry or depressed or whatever, it's and you're grasping. I know that I'm grasping something when this happens. If it, you know, I can feel anger arise when the conditions, say, for anger are present. Somebody humiliates me personally. I can still feel that rage arising, but I know better than to grasp it. There's a difference, isn't it? I'm not the karma. I still have a karma with that, but more and more the confidence comes in non-grasping. Then if I should lose mindfulness with it, then I start grasping it and I get warmed up with how dare they and into this raging mode. I know there's a point where I see I'm grasping and I practice letting go, relinquishing that. Not in suppressing, it's not in getting rid of, but really knowing, you know, this you can test out yourself of relinquishing or letting something be, letting it be what it is, and then it goes naturally, its nature's to cease. So, you know, don't be upset by the fact that even after years of meditation you still feel anger or lust or things like this. That's not the problem, it's the ignorance, the avijja, and the grasping out of that ignorance. So that we have this awareness as our refuge. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.